Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey, friends, welcome to Connecting Faith. Today is, I think it's Tuesday. Yes, it's Tuesday, November the 20th, 2018. I don't know about you, but in Thanksgiving week, I feel like the ramp up to Christmas has already started. I feel a rising sense of pressure related to expectations. I have a friend who their house is already decorated for Christmas, which absolutely made me march right over there with my copy of Brandon Heath's song, which is, I think it's called The Day After Christmas, and just basically, you know, play it in my car with the windows down at, you know, top. I know there's other ways to do it. I probably could have played it on my phone at her front door. That didn't occur to me in the moment. So I was trying to shame her for like already having decorated for Christmas. It's inappropriate. It's not Thanksgiving yet. And it creates pressure on the rest of us. So there you go. So, I don't know how you're feeling, today on this Tuesday before Thanksgiving, but I can tell you that a week from today, you're going to feel different. It's no question about it. Like whatever anxiety, or expectation, joyful expectation you have about Thanksgiving and, Black Friday and grudge match weekend for college football and whatever it is in the NFL, because that's going to happen this weekend too. And then Cyber Monday and then Giving Tuesday. Like, it's no longer just a day. Like, we got a whole thing going on. So I'm going to talk about that in the connecting point, how to manage all that. Here at the outset today, though, I want to talk about the electoral map here in the United States. So it is two weeks ago today that the midterm elections happened here in the United States of America. And yet only today, 2 weeks later, do we actually know the outcomes of many, in fact, many races. And so the electoral map is finally decided. The reds are red, the blues are blue. And some of the blues are red in terms of anger, and some of the reds are blue in terms of depression. And so, you know, I think that we're either increasingly polarized or we're increasingly purple, depending on sort of how you view things. One of the outcomes, though, of all of this is there has certainly been a rising tide. There is a rising tide. There is a notable increase in the number of not just candidates, but places across the country where people who describe themselves as socialists have actually won. And so it's certainly time for us to familiarize ourselves with democratic socialism. What does it mean? Why should we care? And so there were a full, I think, 46 democratic socialists on ballots across the country, put forth for election. Many of them won. And so I think that we need to pay attention to what democratic socialism is, what it means, what it doesn't mean, what people think it means. So I'm going to turn here to a recent Gallup. Gallup.com is where you can find this. A recent Gallup poll on this very question. They ask Americans, and they've actually been asking this question since the late 1940s, since 1949. Gallup first asked Americans their views on the term socialism. So that's what we're going to talk about here for a minute. What do Americans actually think socialism means? So there's a rising tide of interest in socialism. A rising percentage of the American population identify as socialist, are interested in socialism. So what does that mean? Or what do people think it means? Well, 17% of those who responded to the Gallup survey said that socialism means government ownership of the means of production. Now, here's the bad news. Well, the good news is 17% of the American population knows and understands that socialism means the government owns the means of production. Here's the devastatingly bad news. 83% of Americans don't know that that's what it means. Because that's what it means. At its most basic definition, socialism means the government owns the means of production. It has a lot of derivative meanings that that come out of that, but at its most basic definition, government ownership of the means of production is what socialism is all about. If you go back to 1949, there were again, it wasn't a huge number, but nearly 40% of the American population understood that socialism meant government ownership of the means of production. So today, what are the most likely ways that Americans are going to define socialism? Now, just go ahead and just prepare yourself to be devastated for those of you who know what it means. go ahead and grip reality hard here, because I'm just letting you know that the first answer to the question is going to make you want to close your eyes and shake your head. Gallup's most recent survey, asking the question for people to explain their understanding of the term socialism, not an insignificant percentage replied that socialism means people being social and getting along with one another. Now, if socialism were that way, man, I am interested in socialism. If socialism is about people playing nice together and our discourse being re-civilized and us getting along, then socialism sounds like a good thing. And here's the problem. Because of social media, because of social networking, because of the elevation of what it means to be social, right, social beings, people think that socialism must just mean affirming all of that. And who wouldn't affirm all of that? Well, unfortunately, that's not what it means. So there are also those who understand socialism to mean equality for everyone, whatever in the world that means, provision of benefits and social services for everyone. And that would be what you and I understand to be like the derivative understanding of socialism, that it is a redistribution of wealth, would be another way of saying that one. There are also Americans who understand socialism as what they describe as a modified form of communism. Now, by that, I certainly hope they don't mean the reality of communism in the 20th century. They seem to mean this like utopian communism where everyone gets everything, an education, a house, healthcare, every new technology, everything that they've ever wanted under the sun, all paid for by someone else. Now, that is sort of where the nonsense of the whole thing is exposed. And when you hear a person say that they want socialized medicine, or they want they want free college tuition, or they want everyone in America to have a house, a physical house, instead of a home, somewhere to call home. They want everyone to be given a house. Then what you're talking about is a kind of social experiment in which not only does the government control the means of production, the government also controls what everybody gets from the means of production. Now, the most honest Americans who were surveyed, a full quarter of those who were asked by Gallup to define socialism, a full quarter of our neighbors were not able to give an answer at all. So those are the most honest. They don't know what socialism is historically. They don't know what people mean by the term today. They certainly don't know how academicians or politicians or the media are defining it. And so they just shrug their shoulders and say, I don't know. And so you might say to yourself, well, who cares? Who cares? And the reason that we need to care is because 57% of Democrats in this country, Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents, 57% of them view socialism positively. Conversely, they view a greater than 50% view capitalism negatively. And so we have to talk about capitalism and its repudiation, and we have to talk about socialism and its growing acceptance. Let me just go on record as saying this. Socialism is bad. And it's bad that socialism is becoming cool again. Because socialism robs people of the dignity of work, the joy of creation, the incentive to build new things and meet emerging needs. It stifles entrepreneurs because it robs people of the possibility of doing something or making something that others would see of significant value to spend their own money to buy it. And so if you
if you know that if you go out there and you make something and then you try to sell it, which is capitalism, by the way, it's entrepreneurial capitalism. You know, if you want to set up your own, you want to make crafts and you want to sell them on Etsy. Well, you can't do that under socialism because the means of production, your knitting needles or your little crafting, whatever you got going on at home. The government owns that, which means the government also owns what you could make from it, which means if I value it and I want to buy it, I give my money to the government and they give you what they think that widget is worth. All right, friends. So that's essentially what we're talking about here. I think we have to be very clear about what socialists really want. Real socialists are not interested in making America more social or making social media more civil or even a more socialist version of the Democratic Party. What they are interested in is bringing an end to capitalism. Now, that made me think this would be a good time for us to re-up the conversation that I had back in July with Gordon Conwell Seminary professor Kenneth Barnes. He wrote a book called Redeeming Capitalism. So it's not only timely, it's hopeful. So up next, my conversation with Kenneth Barnes about redeeming capitalism. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Hello, friends. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge, and I am joined in conversation by Dr. Kenneth Barnes. He spent many years as a senior international executive for multiple multi-billion dollar companies doing business on six continents. He's also served as a bivocational pastor in both the United States and the UK. And currently, he is a professor. He's actually the chair, the Mockler Phillips Chair at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. He's a tutor of theology and religious studies in Oxford. And he's our guest today to talk about redeeming capitalism. So, Dr. Barnes, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, first of all, let's just talk about your transition. Like, should we think of what people are doing out there in the workaday world as lay people, earning money in the culture, growing the economy, should we think of them differently than we think of professors or pastors? Or are you going to tell us that what we do in work is just part of, you know, sort of why we're here?
Well, exactly right. As far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter what you do. What matters is why you do it, and to some degree, how you do it. The Apostle Paul was very clear. He said we're supposed to do everything as though we're doing it unto the Lord. And he even referred to our work as our worship. So we have a long biblical and especially in the Protestant traditions, a theological tradition that what we do with our lives, which is very often what we do in our work life, matters to God. It matters deeply to God. And it makes sense. I mean, if you think about it, we're created in the image of God, who is the worker par excellence. I mean, the whole story, the whole biblical narrative starts with God at work. And we follow that. We emulate that. So I don't care if you're in paid employment, unpaid employment, working as a caregiver, working as a professor or scrubbing floors or doing a radio show. What matters is your work your worship? Are you dedicating all of your gifts to God?
I'm doing my best to do that. But I do think it's a challenge, right? I do think it's a challenge. And so you have found a way to apply, you know, the full force of your life in a myriad of contexts. And one of the ways that you've done that as the author of many excellent articles and books. And what we want to talk about specifically today is your newest book, which is Redeeming Capitalism. So first of all, let's just start with some definitions. What is capitalism? Why is it good? And why does it need redeeming?
Well, great questions. So let me answer the last one first. It needs redeeming because everything needs redeeming. I stand firmly with Abraham Kuyper when he said, there's no square inch of creation over which God does not proclaim mine, over which Christ does not proclaim mine. We live in a fallen world. We know that. So redemption is necessary, if you will, on a cosmic scale. And that includes every aspect of life. So that's one reason why it needs to be redeemed. But let me answer your first question now. And that is, what is capitalism? Great question, because many people think of capitalism as an object, as though it were some entity with a will and a mind and all of the features of some sort of monster, if you will, that's out there gobbling people up and generating money for the rich and is doing evil things or good things, depending on your perspective. In fact, I start the book by explaining that capitalism is a subject, not an object. Capitalism is just a word that we use to describe the naturally occurring phenomenon of people engaged in economic activity, and particularly economic activity which is market-based, which is highly monetized and lightly regulated. So that's what we call capitalism. Now, there are other economic constructs out there, and we can talk about them, but they're different because they are, in fact, constructs. They were created by people who sought a better, more utopian economic environment, and so they tried to create one. And that's how we get socialism. It's how we get Marxism. It's how we get variations on the theme. So capitalism can either be a force for good, I'm answering your second question now, either be a force for good or not. And what I found in the book is, as I did my research, it really, because it has no moral compass endemic to it, it reflects the morality of the age, it reflects the morality of the culture. So what we have now is postmodern capitalism. Postmodern capitalism really needs redeeming.
Okay, so when you use the term postmodern, so there's a couple of things in your answer that I would love to go back and, you know, till the soil on. One would be, how does postmodern capitalism differ from, and then we'll just go backwards, maybe modern capitalism and then maybe historic capitalism. And I don't know, was there a colonial capital? I mean, I don't know. So, right. So that's, we can go backwards. And then the other conversation I would love to have is to hear you talk about this competing economic construct, which maybe we use the word socialism, maybe we use the word Marxism, but we see the outcomes of those in other places in the world. And yet we hear people in our country clamoring as if that's the way that we want to go. So I realize those are two very different questions and probably both very long answers. So take them in whichever order that you want to take them. But those are the conversations I'd love to have.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me say that we shouldn't convolute socialism and Marxism because they aren't the same thing. There are similarities, but they are absolutely not the same thing. We can park that and come back to it. But let's talk about what I mean by postmodern capitalism. When I set out to look for the soul of capitalism, as it were, and this was, frankly, in response to the global financial crisis, I looked at three epochs, three periods in history. The first is what I call traditional capitalism. That was the capitalism that would have been observed by Adam Smith. That was the nascent capitalism that emerged out of the end of the mercantilist period, and was really driven by the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and also the liberalization of economic rules and the privatization of corporations, etc. So what we found as capitalism evolved out of this primordial ooze is that it was still undergirded by, if you will, an Enlightenment interpretation of classic Judeo-Christian values. So Adam Smith, who we all know, wrote a very famous book called Wealth of Nations, which people who are supportive of free market capitalism often point to, forget that he was not an economist. He was a moral philosopher. And you can't understand Adam Smith and his beliefs about morality and economics if you don't go back to his previous work, which was called Moral Sentiment, where he lays out what the moral foundations of society should be, including in our economics. So that traditional Judeo-Christian understanding of why we have business in the first place, why we create wealth in the first place, is primarily for the common good. It's for human flourishing. The title of the book was An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, not the Wealth of People, not the wealth of individuals or even corporations, but the wealth of nations. So that's a particular construct. If you fast forward to the period that Max Weber is famous for and the famous Protestant work ethic, that was a very specific ethic rooted in a Judeo-Christian tradition, specifically a kind of neo-puritanical form of Calvinism, where you had an ordering of everyone's everyday life according to their belief system. And you had a this-worldly asceticism, is the term he uses, which drove capitalism, especially in America, to be an extremely efficient wealth creation engine. But again, the morality was very puritanical. And consequently, you didn't see a lot of the excess you see in today's version of capitalism. In fact, you saw an awful lot of philanthropy and people reinvesting in order to spread the wealth, not hoard the wealth. Now, however, we have something different, and Max Weber warned us of this. Max Weber warned his readers that if America as a culture were to ever lose touch with these fundamental Protestant ethics, that what evolved later could be a very dangerous form of capitalism, a very unjust form of capitalism. So what do we have today? Well, we don't have religious hegemony in any form. What we have is a postmodern relativism and a hermeneutic of suspicion. People don't trust each other anymore. They don't trust their institutions anymore. They don't have faith in God anymore. So all they do primarily is look after themselves. And we have this rather perverse belief that ethical egoism is the ethic that should be driving capitalism. And I take exception to that in the book. I say we need virtue and we need faith, hope, and love if we want an economic system that's not going to turn on itself and exacerbate the problems we've seen in 2008 and at other times.
All right, friends, I know that you are now looking for the title of the book. So it's Redeeming Capitalism. The author is Kenneth Barnes. Kenneth, you have a way with words that is provocative. You speak with great clarity, and I really appreciate that. And you do so in the book as well. And so I think that if folks are looking for a book that really, I mean, you start with sort of the global financial crisis of 2008, and you sort of describe, like, what it is and what it is not. And then you talk about, you know, what we need to be doing in terms of, I think recovery might be the word, but redeeming is the question. You know, is capitalism redeemable? So let's have that conversation when we come back from the break. Again, friends, my conversation partner is Dr. Kenneth Barnes. The book is Redeeming Capitalism. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge, and we'll be right back. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am joined in conversation today by Dr. Kenneth Barnes. He is currently a professor at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. He is a tutor of theology and religious studies at Oxford. Historically, though, he spent a lot of years as a senior international executive in all kinds of companies around the world doing business on six continents. So he actually knows of what he speaks when he is talking about capitalism, and he has seen it do not only do well, but do good. And he is talking with us about what it is, and we've discussed why it needs redeeming. And now I think we'll ask the question, is it redeemable? What do you think, Dr. Barnes?
Well, it absolutely is. And, you know, I didn't choose that word redemption lightly, because really what redemption means is to overcome the effects of sin. And that's why we have problems at times in this system, which has such wonderful potential to do good. That's why we have problems, because greed creeps in, because dishonesty creeps in, because selfishness creeps in, because fear creeps in. And what happens is people react to that in several ways. One way is they say, well, you know, let's just pass more laws. Let's just regulate it more tightly. And what I tell people is we defer to the law and we defer to regulation when ethics fail. My book is a clarion call to a return to ethics so that we don't need to defer to the rather blunt instrument of law, which very often is one step behind the bad guys anyway. So it is redeemable if we call on this wonderful reservoir of spiritual capital that's available to us because of our faith tradition. And most of the people who have written in this space before, they talk about the so-called cardinal virtues of prudence and justice and courage and temperance. And I unpack all of those in the book, and I agree 100% that we need those things. But what's a little bit different about my book is I don't stop there. I'm not afraid to talk about the theological virtues, because whether you're a person of faith or not, even in our pluralistic, complicated world in which we live, the theological virtues of faith and hope and love are universal because they relate to what it means to be created in the image of God. So we need to bring faith back into our economics and back into capitalism. And we've lost faith, and I'm very concerned about it. I'm sure you are too. I tell people we live in a post-truth era because we live in a post-faith era. How can you believe anything to be true if you don't have faith in the veracity of the source? So for people of faith, for believers, for most of your listeners, that means faith in God. But even for non-believers, they should be able to get on board with this program because we need faith in something bigger than ourselves. And we need to regain faith in the system itself, faith in capitalism, faith in markets, faith in each other, faith in all of the things that make it work. Because faith delivers hope. And if you look at all the research that's happening now, you find that one of the reasons why we have such a complicated political environment is because a lot of people have lost hope. They don't think the system's working for them. They look at a college education, they go, how am I going to put my kids through college for $250,000? Or how am I going to save money for my first house if you're a millennial? Or, you know, why is it that it seems the rich are getting richer and it's not trickling down? That's why you have statistics like millennials. Only 19% of millennials even self-identify as capitalists. So we need to bring faith and hope back into the system. And both of those things are built on love. And this is what I tell everybody. As a culture, we have completely redefined and misdefined love. We treat it as a mawkish emotion, something that you find on the back of a greeting card. And for Christians, love is identified by the cross. It's about self-sacrifice. So we need to bring that kind of ethos of care for the other, care for each other, back into our economic system. Then we can redeem it.
So, Ken, I think that if I'm hearing you correctly, we're talking about a restoration, a redemption of capitalism that's about wealth generation for the common good, and it's only going to happen as individuals in the culture are possessed of these virtues of faith, hope, and love, of prudence, justice, courage, and temperance, and then live those virtues out in real ethics in the workplace and in the culture at large. And the distance between where we are now and there is going to require, some mammoth, it's not just re-education, because it's not just about knowing what is just. It's about the willingness to make the sacrifice to actually create justice. Or it's not just knowing what temperance is. It's about not doing today what I might do in order that I preserve the opportunity to do tomorrow what I want to do, right? So I think that, if there's a family that wants to send their kid to college, well, they have to make decisions today that enable them to do that 15 years down the road, not wake up when their kid is 15 and wonder, who's going to pay for the college education of this child who what, suddenly became 15. And so I think this is part of the, you know, part of the challenge is how do we fix what's broken now while we are also raising up a new generation of people who actually think and feel and function differently in terms of these ethical concerns?
Wow, that's hitting the nail right on the head. Thank you for that.
I bring a hammer every single day, man. I bring a hammer.
Great. Well, let me tell you what I say in the book. First of all, I say in the book that this book is not a manifesto for a movement. It's the credo of a community who believes we can do better. And there are no quick fixes. I have a whole chapter on Karl Marx, and I think I give a very fair reading of Marx. I have a whole chapter on Bernie Sanders and the Occupy Wall Street movement and other utopian movements, and I think I give a fair assessment of them. But ultimately, I come down on the side of they don't work, and there are a lot of reasons why they don't work, and I unpack that in the book. So the alternative, instead of going back and making the same mistake that other generations who have been here before do, is we've got to start this process now, firstly, by changing the narrative. We've got to change the narrative from this ethical egoism that we see all the time, this really perverse kind of Ayn Rand kind of philosophy that says if individuals only look after themselves, everybody will ultimately benefit. That's not a Christian concept at all. And so we need to start saying we're in this together, and we need to be self-loving. There's absolutely no reason why people shouldn't be encouraged and incentivized to improve their own lot and that of their families. There's nothing wrong with making money and even becoming wealthy. But Jesus does warn us that to whom much is given, much is expected, and wealth comes with both risks and responsibilities. But if we change the narrative back to one of virtue happens when virtuous people do virtuous things, because we know even from scientific studies on the production of oxytocin that when we do good things, our bodies crave the feeling we get from doing more good things. So it's not about just doing virtuous things. It's about becoming virtuous people, which means we create then virtuous business cultures, virtuous communities, virtuous churches, a virtuous nation. And it takes time. It takes a lot of time. And sin is working against us. But as people of faith, we have to believe that redemption is possible. As people of faith, we have to believe that God is sovereign and ultimately God will win. And unfortunately, what I see very often is people throw in the towel and they say, I don't want to do this hard stuff. I don't want to put in the time and the effort to change the narrative. I just want to change the law or change the system. And we've got to resist that. We've got to fix this thing from the inside. Because I'll tell you what, despite all of its shortcomings, capitalism is a brilliant system for creating wealth and enhancing human flourishing. We just have to do it the right way.
So let's talk about, because you and I have now each used the phrase creating wealth. There seems to be a misunderstanding out there, you know, about like even how this happens. There are those who actually think, you know, like there's a fixed pie. And so it has to be sliced. And in order for, you know, more and more people to have more pie, everybody has to have a thinner slice. And instead of understanding that, like, the way capitalism works, you can actually make the pie. You can make more pie. Like, you know, there's pie. And there can be more pie. So just talk about when you use the phrase wealth creation, which is, you know, for the common good, and it's for, you know, human flourishing, and it promotes philanthropy, and on and on and on. Explain to people what that means.
Sure. Thanks for asking that question, because I do give people a definition of wealth they probably will not have heard before, but I think it's the simplest definition you can have. And that is that wealth is nothing more than the delta between the amount of labor and resources necessary for subsistence and everything else. That delta is wealth. And this is where Marx went wrong, by the way. Marx's definition of wealth had to do with the accumulative value of all commodities. So he saw wealth as exactly that, something that was finite. And what he didn't understand was that human labor, technology, ingenuity, these things combine to create wealth, because we can constantly increase that delta between what's necessary for subsistence and everything else. So wealth creation is absolutely positive. However, we can also create an environment that makes it hard to create wealth by disincentivizing or misusing resources or not taking care of the environment or not allowing markets to do what markets do best. So these things work in tandem with each other. So it's a question of explaining to people that it's not a question of redistribution. It's a question of creating wealth in ways that work for everyone, in ways that are fair, that are just. So what I say in the book is we have to start redeeming capitalism first by redeeming work. What do we mean by work? What is the benefit of work? How does work contribute to wealth creation? How do we create a positive, life-enhancing theology of work that people can buy into? The other thing we have to do is we have to redeem money. And what I mean by that is this is one of the great sources of the problem. Because we have fiat money, because we have money that isn't rooted in anything tangible, people confuse money with wealth. And in fact, money is only a representation of wealth. So if the money supply starts to get out of skew, if we do things like radically increase our debt, quantitative easing, etc., in order to create an illusion of growth, people are going to sense that, and they're going to realize that the accumulation and concentration of money is one of the things that's giving the appearance of injustice in the system. So we need to redeem money. We need to find a way to bring back this relationship between wealth and money. And the best way I can describe it is this way. Since 2008, the gross domestic product of America was between 2.5% and 2% per year for, say, 8 years until 2016. That increased our GDP by about $2 trillion. But in the same period of time, we increased our national debt by $10 trillion and added $4 trillion to the economy through quantitative easing. That would be like a business owner telling the shareholders, I increased our P&L account by $2 billion, but had to take $14 billion off the balance sheet to do it. That CEO would be fired. So we've got to do these things. We've got to be more prudent, more thriftful, more conscious of what we're doing for how it affects the system.
Dr. Kenneth Barnes, I could talk about this all day. Friends, if you want to engage in this subject matter, the book is Redeeming Capitalism. The author is Kenneth Barnes. You can grab your copy at Amazon or from Erdman's directly. Dr. Barnes, is there a way that people can, you know, sort of like follow what you're doing? Do you have a social media follow?
The best way to do it is the website, which is redeemingcapitalism.org.
There we go. That's what we'll do.
Go ahead. So that's the best one. Good.
Yeah, that's great.
Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, it's been an absolute joy to have you on with us today. Thank you for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, we'll be making the connecting point. I'm Carmen LaBerge, and you're listening to Connecting Faith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I was just kind of enjoying the song, and I kind of forgot that, hey, I have a job to do. Welcome back. It is like Thanksgiving Eve Eve. Mm-hmm. So if you haven't already started planning for Thursday, today's the day, like, to get that together. Like, start getting that together. So I want to speak specifically here in today's Connecting Point to those of you who are hosting Thanksgiving. And if you're not hosting Thanksgiving, then maybe this will be an opportunity to think about being a good guest on Thanksgiving, wherever you are going to be feasting with whoever it is that's hosting. So we're going to have, I don't know, like at least 19 people at our house. Now, five of those are like officially little, like four and under. So, but you can't not count them because they do count and they need a place to sit. And actually they need some particular special provision. And you know, you don't want your tablecloth to hang down too low because that's just like a grab on for little toddler people who like to pull stuff. So anyway, there's lots of thought that has to go into who's coming and where are they going to sit. And if you have an older adult, you know, let's make sure we're going to accommodate them in a way that's comfortable. So there's a lot going into planning for Thanksgiving. And if you host Thanksgiving, I know there's a lot that goes into planning for that. Like you make your list, you check it twice. And regardless of who's naughty and nice, they need to be fed. In fact, overfed. That's what we do. That is what Thanksgiving is, at least in America, partially all about. So what is going to happen at your Thanksgiving table? This is the question to those of you who are hosting Thanksgiving. What is going to happen at your Thanksgiving table? Is God going to be the one getting the glory? Will Christ be made known in the breaking of the bread? I can tell you that in preparation for hosting Thanksgiving, I spend a fair amount of time having some serious Jesus talks about not with myself. Like I'm talking to Jesus, but really there's a lot of like Carmen. This is not going to be perfect in all of the ways that you might imagine. I tend to get very stressed out on the actual day because I'm so ready and I want everything to be so nice and I want to be such a good hostess and I want everything to be perfect that then I tend to get kind of out of sorts. And so I'm really working hard this year to have that not be true, to be as ready as I can be, and then just enjoy the day and the fellowship of those whom God gathers into our home. And I'm going to keep this in front of me. I'm going to keep in front of me that what we are seeking to do when we host Thanksgiving, what we're seeking to do is actually offer people a provisional demonstration of the gospel, a glimpse into the kingdom of heaven, a bounty, a harvest, and definitely a place where people felt like they were expected, where they are welcome, and where they can make themselves at home. So what does it look like as an ambassador of the kingdom of heaven to host Thanksgiving? That's really the question for today's connecting point. What does it look like as an ambassador of the kingdom of heaven to host Thanksgiving? So how is it that God wants to use my home on Thanksgiving and my hospitality as a provisional demonstration of the gospel, as a glimpse into what it is going to be like to sit down in fellowship in the kingdom of God? Well, obviously Christ is going to be the host, right? And he's expecting us and we are welcome. He actually makes it possible for us to enter in. And then he wants us to make ourselves at home. And so in the same way that that I anticipate being welcomed into the Father's home, into the kingdom of heaven, I want people, when they arrive at my home on Thanksgiving, to know that I was expecting them, that they are welcome, and then that I genuinely invite them to make themselves at home. Recognizing that that is, at a human level, going to stress me out. But that's okay. So then let me encourage you, if you don't already have some kind of genuine, like actual practice of how at your Thanksgiving meal Christ is going to be central, let me offer you this idea. And let me offer it with a recipe, because I always think that's fun for Thanksgiving. So for this, you really need to make monkey bread. And if you're not familiar with monkey bread, you get like a bundt pan and you get frozen yeast rolls, and then you melt a lot of butter and you put some of the butter in there, and then you put the frozen yeast rolls in there and you let them thaw out, and then you let them rise and you put more butter on it and then you bake them. Now, the reason you're doing it this way is so you'll have one loaf. It's going to be, you know, shaped like whatever your bundt pan is shaped like. You have one common loaf, but it's like pull-apart bread, because those rolls will each individually come out of the common loaf really easily. And you're going to feel better when I tell you what we're doing with that, because we're going to pass it around and everybody is going to pull a roll out of the common loaf. This is the idea behind this is, as you are passing that around as the first thing, before you pass around anything else at your Thanksgiving meal, you pass around the monkey bread, the pull-apart bread, and everybody takes a piece from it. And this is where you remind them as the host, you say something like, "Welcome to Thanksgiving. In our home, we acknowledge that Christ is the host. And apart from him, we don't have any reason to give thanks. But because of him, we have reason to give great thanks in the midst of any circumstance." And then you say something like, you know, there's a story in the Bible about two people who they had these great expectations, but they'd lost all hope after Jesus died. And they were walking from Jerusalem to Emmaus, and a guy came with them, and they didn't recognize it, but it was the risen Christ. And he joined them. And the Bible says that after hearing their concerns, after hearing their heart, after understanding their longing for the Messiah, Jesus actually opened the scriptures to them and showed them God's redemptive plan. He actually explained reality to them, in the gospel. And we're sitting here today as a fellowship of Christ. And it's our heart's desire in this home that Christ would be made known in the breaking of this bread. So let us feast together. And then in our house, we would also invite people to pray as the Lord taught us to pray, because it is a common prayer that folks tend to know. And if you don't think that everybody is going to know it, you could print it on the placemats. You could print it on the card that their name is on, their little place card. There's lots of ways to do this. So you're going to pray through the Lord's Prayer. And that's going to give you fodder for conversation as well. What does it mean for us to pray, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven"? What part do we then play as kingdom ambassadors to make those realities known here on the earth? What does it mean for God to give us our daily bread? And what does it mean for God to forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us? Who do we need to forgive? Like, how on this Thanksgiving do I need to manifest the reality of the forgiveness that I've received by extending it to someone else? So on and on, right? We serve our Thanksgiving meal family style. Yes, it's a mess. Yes, it takes lots of time. Yes, it would be easier to do it as a buffet. Encourage people to get all they want. But there's something communal, genuinely communal, about passing food around. There's some kind of foretaste of the kingdom of heaven in tasting and seeing all of that. And don't slack on the pie. Like, right, whatever you do, don't slack on the pie. The Christian faith is not pie in the sky. It is pie right now. You and I are in the world to help people taste and see that the Lord is good. And then, of course, yes, there are leftovers. Leftovers give us the opportunity to tell the story of God's extravagant love revealed in, like, the wedding at Cana and in the feeding of the 5,000. And so make sure you have prepared to send leftovers home with people so that tomorrow, or the day after Thanksgiving in this case, they can have another feast that reminds them of the bread that was broken at your table and the hospitality of your home, and that maybe in their own home and in their own way, they would catch the vision of having Christ be made known in the breaking of the bread at every meal. This is one way that you and I can pass on to others what we in turn have also received, this gospel goodness, this redemptive understanding of reality. So welcome people in, feed them to the full, make sure they go home with leftovers. You have been listening to Connecting Faith. I am your host, Carmen LaBerge. Happy Thanksgiving Eve. Have a great day and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.